the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast from ExchangeWire, your weekly dose of news and analysis from the worlds of media, marketing and e-commerce. I'm John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Tessa Conrad, Head of Innovation at TBWA APAC. Tessa, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here and dive into things.
No, thank you very much for taking time in what is, of course, your evening over in Singapore.
All good. No worries.
I'm also delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire CEO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, welcome back.
Hello. I'm delighted to be back. I'm feeling like I'm more of a regular podcast guest these days. It's great fun.
I know you've been on weekly for a while now. This is excellent. We've got a good routine. Yeah. Well, I have three more excellent stories for you to get your teeth into today. And we're going to start with video content. And YouTube execs fear that shorts are going to kill the more lucrative long-form content. Long-form videos, which can generate more revenue, might be at risk from disappearing as more consumers opt for bite-sized content, executives are reportedly fearing. Content creators on YouTube are seemingly moving away from longer videos to cater to this trend. YouTube has reported a decline in ad revenue across consistent quarters in late 2022 and early 2023, but have recorded a 4.4% rise in Q2 this year. So, we've been hearing about this for a while in terms of, you know, the popularity of short-form bite-sized videos. Tessa, are the days of long-form content over?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's more than enough room for both, right? I mean, if I'm working at a company where I have both long and short-term, of course I'd be a little bit nervous about cannibalizing it. But from a consumption standpoint, right, it has to follow consumer behavior. So whether it's worry of that bottom line going down doesn't really matter because consumers are actively consuming more short form, but still long form. So you've got to make that shift and be able to cover both, I think. I also think that's why it's interesting, right? Like YouTube is shifting shorter with shorts while also offering long, and TikTok that started out super short is shifting with a little bit longer, even more than YouTube Shorts. So you see them expanding. I mean, I definitely think there's room for both. We do a ton of amazing like TikTok content, Snap content, etc. But we also just had a really popular Nissan 4-hour ad on YouTube that like was in the vibes, like diving into a little bit of anime, and it's just like nice background soothing content. So again, I think it just depends what you're trying to achieve. But this or that, I think, doesn't have to be the debate, rather both. That's kind of my view.
Yeah, did you say 4 hours? Sorry, John. Did you say yes. 4 hours?
What? And it's one of the most consumed, obviously, ads that we make, but that's where you have to dive into entertainment, right? Yeah. If you want to make something that people want to see, then people will see it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that is fascinating. Sorry, John, go on.
No, you've just said the two things I were going to say. One was that a 4-hour ad? And the second was that it's fascinating. So yeah, don't worry, you've just jumped ahead of me. But yeah, carry on, Rachel. What do you think on this discussion?
Well, I think I think Tess has got a really interesting perspective here, having, as you know, as you just said, been part of a team that's, you know, helped to create a 4-hour advert commercial for a client.
And lots of TikToks.
So, you know, but they're two completely different perspectives, which means that, you know, are we now getting into the territory when we're talking about long form versus short form content? Frankly, not just in video, but also written content that we consume. Are we now getting into the territory where we're kind of comparing apples and oranges? You know, for a long time, we've just, because we haven't had so much choice, you know, we've just seen it all as a similar medium, whereas actually maybe what we're now seeing is a complete differentiation, and short form content will have a place and long form content will also still have a place. You know, it's the old kind of like cinema, watching films at home, etc. Not saying that you know, when we see those shifts in consumer behavior, that it doesn't signal, you know, a new era where things are significantly different from the way that they've been before. But I like Tessa's perspective that actually the conversation should be rather about perhaps the quality and what we're watching short form content for and how we're consuming it versus what we're watching long form content for and what we're anticipating from that and what we're expecting from it, and therefore it's not an either or. But I wonder how brands see this. So obviously the sort of, you know, long form ad opportunity will appeal to particular brands, and as per TikTok, you know, content will appeal to particular brands. But what, you know, what's your experience of this, Tessa? Are you finding that brands are getting experimental with these different lengths of content, and or is it more a case of following the audience and searching for reach?
Yeah, I think to me, it goes to both of those things, right? Like, if you are following the audience, then you have to be open to experimentation, right? And that's our hope and what we're experiencing for a lot of the brands we're working with. I mean, it comes down to what do you want to achieve, which really starts with strategy, right? Like, what are your KPIs? I think for perhaps too long, some in the industry would have focused more on like, view-through rates or impressions, and those things are good, right? But what do you want your audiences to achieve through interacting with your content? So like, for instance, one of the long-form pieces of content that I like that's quite straightforward from brands and that a lot of our brands make is how-to tutorials. Like whether it's a new phone or a new car or new things, like it is tricky, right? And let's be real, no one is really reading the instruction guide to a lot of these things. Now, YouTube, though, also makes that super simple, where I've noticed, like, when you search on Google how to do this specific thing, even if it takes you to a long-form video, it will peg you to the time code of where it's solving that exact problem, which is quite ingenious, right? So then me, as a consumer, I can make the decision whether I want to watch just that snippet or all of it. And the same is true for, you know, reviews or entertainment purposes, etc. So I think our brands are definitely trying to follow the audiences, but to make sure that we're not just showing up there as, you know, another touch point or another format, but instead being very mindful of when people are consuming this, what are they looking to engage with, and how can we ensure that marriage so that it's not a boring ad that people flip through, and instead it's a piece of content that people are actually actively seeking out in ideal worlds, right?
Yeah, I mean, that links with what I was going to say about this article, which is that it ties in very closely to attention, right? So the debate about long form versus short form often falls hand in hand with, is it because consumers' attention just keeps getting shorter and shorter? You know, we're bombarded with too many messages across too many channels and too many mediums. So, you know, and we're now living in a world where, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I can see that my patience is reducing, you know, sort of year on year for trying to get to the crux of whatever I'm tuning into content for, whether that's an entertainment story or whether that's, you know, something that's more tutorial oriented. So tactics that you just mentioned there, Tessa, like, you know, pegging the content to a particular, you know, a particular issue or a particular topic or a particular part of either the entertainment reel or the tutorial reel is super helpful. And that makes me think that actually, it gives me hope that actually we're not moving to a world of just shorter and short, you know, like a zero-sum game of constantly reducing everybody's attention down to this minute couple of seconds. But instead, what we're doing is giving people more choice so they can consume the things they want when they want and where they want. And I guess the argument goes, that's how you're going to hold people's attention better, is if you're actually guiding them around the experience and you're showing them quality advertising as part of that, whether it's more entertainment style advertising or whether it's advertising that's attached to the beginning and the end of something that's more tutorial or more information oriented. So that's a really hopeful way of looking at it. Because I have to admit, when I first read this article, I thought, oh yeah, here we go. I don't know. Like, are we just going to be producing human beings in another 30 years time that cannot pay attention to anything for longer than 30 seconds? You know, that's my fear, but maybe not.
I mean, I think the fear is valid, but I also think, like, when you look at creativity, especially when it comes to marketing, right, like, it ebbs and flows. I feel like 10 years ago, everyone was quoting that thing, like, goldfish have longer attention spans than humans. And I'm pretty sure that was later, like, disproven, even though I definitely referenced it myself, right? Like, oh, I read this somewhere. But like, it comes down to interest, right? Because you also see brands went through a period and are still going through a period of where we're going into more like long form documentary types. Like, have you guys ever seen Drive to Survive, for instance? That is an amazing ad for Formula One. And Formula One viewership greatly increased across the world when that series launched on different streaming platforms. Now, is it an ad? Is it marketing? Is it creative? I don't know. I know it's content and different people make it for different purposes. But if the story is there and it can convince someone that something that had an audience that wasn't definitely at its peak and is starting to go downhill and spikes that up again, that's amazing, right? And people yeah. have to pay attention to it for a reason if they have any spark of interest. I think when it's mindless stuff, right? When you have people kind of trapped looking at yourself, that's where, of course, people are going to zone out. That's where, of course, we're going to say attention is very low on this, because why would someone sit there and watch something that's being force-fed to them? How would that resonate with their brain, right? So I think it's always being mindful and hopeful, I guess, but using that to spur creativity rather than be like, we must fill these individual boxes with whatever we create.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, John, we've been vibing.
Exactly.
We're cutting
That's
you
why
off.
I'm shutting
Go
up.
Ahead.
Go, John.
This is the best kind of podcast. This is good. I like this. The less I say, the better. I just think it's fascinating points, Tessa. Drive to Survive is sort of, like you say, not really sure if it's marketing, if it's branding, if it's a documentary, but it's the gold standard for it. It's got massively tangible results for Formula One, and it's an amazing watch. Personally, I'm glued to each series, and it condenses a whole F1 season into a short series, which is also very useful. But no, it's fascinating. Rachel, I shared your fear of the 30-second attention span coming fast. I like long-form content myself, but also I think your point about the instruction videos and the time codes and the short form within the long form. So it's not cannibalization, it's partnership, and it's fascinating. So yeah, we'll see how attention spans continue to shorten and how brands make use of all formats. I'm going to move us on to our next subject. And this is about fake advertising, a really interesting story that's cropped up in the last couple of weeks. Gymbox have received a backlash after revealing that their latest ad campaign was completely fabricated. The creative, which was a picture of a double-decker bus featuring an ad on top for the brand's aerial classes on the roof, was revealed to be fake, and it was showcased as an edited stock image. The stunt has sparked debate over the importance of campaigns' physical authenticity, with people expressing concerns that the fake ads will reduce trust among consumers. Rachel, I'll chuck this to you first. Does it matter if an ad campaign or creative is real and authentic?
I find the answer to that question somewhat of a dilemma, because my natural inclination is to say, yes, it does matter. It shouldn't be fake. It should be real. Isn't that why we've got advertising standards in place? You know, you're not allowed to make false claims about the products that you're advertising. So ought you be allowed to create false imagery in order to promote those products? Doesn't feel morally right, and doesn't really feel like it follows that sort of the guardrails that are set out by advertising and consumer codes. On the other hand, we create fake imagery all the time, right? Isn't that part of creativity? It's not, and then it sparks the debate of what is fake and what is real. You know, the argument could be put forward. I mean, I expect that the PR agency that was behind this for Gymbox knew exactly what they were doing at the time, but the argument could be put forward that actually they were just trying to create an image, which is if someone is, you know, wistfully sat at their desk wishing they were somewhere else, looking out the window of a high-rise office and down onto a London street, they might see the top of a bus and they might see this ad on the top of a bus, and it's a great ad and it would be a great moment in which to see that ad, right, because it would really grab your attention. And maybe that's enough. Certainly it's enough for the message, right? Because everyone sees the ad and goes, cool, that's pretty cool. But you know, the idea that it doesn't exist becomes, I think, a sort of a moral and an ethical debate. And I instinctively want to say it's wrong, but then the other side of me feels that they have used some, you know, some creative license here to illustrate a point. The other thing I thought about this, though, when I looked at it was, you know, out-of-home advertising and digital out-of-home advertising in particular, but also out-of-home advertising's really bounced back this year, you know, probably as a result of consumer habits continuing to change post-pandemic and go back to much more of an out-of-home lifestyle than we had for a couple of years there during the pandemic. But I think also because it's a popular format, right? Like out-of-home advertising catches you in a completely different moment in time. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I find myself enjoying a lot of out-of-home advertising because it catches me in that moment where I just think, oh, that's actually a really cool ad. And that's what I thought about this Gymbox ad when I first looked at it. I thought, I wish I'd seen that from a window of a building in London. That would have been super cool. So I don't know, but, you know, out-of-home advertising specialists must be annoyed that it's not real because the whole process, you know, the whole point of it was to evoke feelings of, you know, this is a great ad. It sounds like I'm sitting on the fence. I think it's wrong to mislead consumers, to blatantly mislead consumers. But then again, we need to ask ourselves lots of questions about how we're creating imagery in the round, holistically.
Yeah, what do you think, Tessa?
I'm glad you went first because then I can also mention morals in mine. You have a completely different take from me, I think. I mean, I have a few thoughts. Like, one, I am surprised that this started such a controversy. Like, and I'm also curious, like, who is part of the controversy, right? And my hypothesis would be it's mostly people within the industry rather than consumers, which means, like, if it's the industry, I get it, but if it's achieving the mission of capturing attention with consumers as well, then it worked. Because I focus on innovation, right? So maybe my opinion is slightly skewed. Like, I spend a lot of time in gaming worlds or in virtual reality. And even amongst, like, my friends, my colleagues, I have a lot of debate and I get a little made fun of because when I say, like, real world, I always use quotation marks because what is real? Is it the physical world? Is it the virtual world? Or is my world both? Like, whatever I make it, right? If it's all a construct in our brains, then I think we've got to open up our minds a little bit. So when something is fake, I completely hear you, Rachel, and agree on, like, the ethics around true advertising and deceiving customers. I would feel strongly if it was showcasing something that the product or experience didn't deliver, right? Because that's false advertising. If it's just the experience, I don't really see the issue. Like, I think it's interesting because, like, I guess my pivot would be if we saw an out of home then somewhere that was instead that picture, like on an up high sky rise of that bus, would we think that's cool or would that make it real because it's in the physical world? I don't know. I think it gets you talking. And as you said, I mean, there's a lot of issues, right, around like things like Photoshop, how Photoshop is to Photoshop. I think we have more pressing ethical considerations to, like, really think about than, like, a freaking fake bus billboard. But it's an interesting spark debate, right, that so many people are kind of, like, frothing about it.
Yeah. And I reckon that's it. Sorry, John, go.
No, I'd much rather see a fake image of an ad on a bus than a fake statistic on a real bus. But that's just a little Brexit joke for
me
you
too.
There.
yeah, thank you very much, yeah, Bruce Johnson.
Carry on, Rachel, sorry.
No, I think that's it. I think, Tessa, you've hit the nail on the head. I expect that the majority of the debate was initiated from within the industry and it will have come from a number of corners, people that feel a bit envious that they didn't think of it first because it is a good ad, you're right, and then those that feel strongly about the authenticity, I suppose, of, like I said, what appears to be out-of-home advertising. But you're absolutely right. We've got much bigger battles to moderate, really, than this one. And you raise a really good point. There's plenty of, I've got to use air quotes in the reverse now, not in the real world, interactions that involve advertising and marketing. And, you know, how do we feel about those? So actually, I think it's probably one of the reasons that the debate got so much, you know, snowballed so quickly is because it really feeds into all of the conversations we're having about responsible use of AI, about AI and creativity, about the fears and anxieties that we naturally have concerning how we will, as human beings in the future, discern real content from fake content, not just, you know, advertising content imagery, but written word and everything, you know, even interactions with people online, whether they're real people or whether they're bots or what, you know, or other AI-generated images. So I think it's tapping into all of those anxieties, and that's what's given this debate fuel. But yeah, at the end of the day, it was a really good ad, you know. Like I said, I wish it did. The main reason I wish it existed in real life is because I would have liked to have seen that. I would have liked to have been, you know, pondering, looking out a window, going, "Oh, great ad! What a moment in time." But otherwise, I think it was fairly harmless, and I think it's important for us to continue the important parts of the debate and worry less about the rest of it.
Yeah, I think. I mean, from the consumer side, I think that's where the jealousy almost comes in, Rachel, because I would like to have seen that ad. I would like to have seen the tube train with eyelashes that got mascara put on it, which was an AI generated campaign. I saw one this morning for a makeup brand using lipstick on the streets of Paris, which was again augmented reality, but very, very interesting campaigns. It's heightened creativity, and it's interesting. I think there are discussions to be had about it and where it, you know, where consumers find themselves with it. But no, it's very interesting, and I'm sure, I mean, do you think we're going to see a lot more of this, Tessa?
I mean, given the attention of this, I'd say yes. I also think, like, as technology continues to evolve, right, like, per both of your points, that crossover is going to become more and more apparent. So definitely, I mean, augmented reality is a really good example of that, I think, because, you know, like the lipstick or the eyelashes, that's been around for a while, but it's starting to get more specific as well with like the geospatial type of pegging that you can do, which is interesting. What's fake? I mean, I'm still really torn on what makes something real. So yes, I think we'll see it more and more. I think as our physical and virtual world start to come together. Yes, I think AI in terms of like enablement of creativity will help bring the possibility of that forward more too. And I think it's scary, sure, but also isn't it lucky that we're part of this time where these things are happening and we get to have a say in how they evolve through what we do every day, both as professionals and as consumers. I think, you know, fear and excitement are kind of two sides of the same coin, right? So I'm excited, probably more than scared at this point, at least, until the robots come for me.
You're head of innovation, Tessa. You're going to know before everyone else.
Hopefully they'll know I'm their friend.
Yeah, you'll be set aside and saved by them, I'm sure. Falling back into a more traditional medium now, we're going to discuss TV and whether TV has fallen out of favour with marketers. According to Kantar, TV has become less popular among marketers. The latest edition of the firm's Media Reactions report found that TV has fallen to the 12th most popular channel among advertisers, a really steep drop as it was in third last year. The study also found out that TV sponsorship has fallen out of favour and that 2024 will see only 6% of marketers increase spend on the channel. Tessa, for you first here, what's happening to TV? Are marketers now looking for the shiny new things instead of the TV option?
I think it comes back to, you know, what we've talked about, I think, throughout even the first two stories is we've got to follow where people are spending their time, right? And like with the rise of like even so many streaming platforms with ad-free units or support it with ads but still paid, the money that is spent on marketing will follow where the focus is. I know attention will be probably one of the big things we talk about on this conversation as well. I think TV will be all right, but of course, with the proliferation of so many different touch points to connect with people, you've got to find the ones that are most meaningful to you. I think also, I mean, in traditional marketing days, right, we always talked about the funnel of attention, and it was very much focused on TV is for awareness, right? And it does bring that trust in that if you can afford to put something on TV in a way that's going to reach potentially millions of people, surely you're doing something good in business that enough people have supported you. I mean, when you look at today's world, though, as the customer journey has become very, very messy and muddled, where people can enter at any given point and interact with the brand, I think awareness, engagement, and like conversion have also become super, super blended in a lot of scenarios. Whereas you can now sometimes with good creative content, right, achieve awareness, even if you're focusing on pushing hard conversion through something like a TikTok. Likewise, though, you'll see a lot more of the younger, and not younger in terms of consumer, younger in terms of years they've been in the business as a company, companies striving to be on TV to show a wider audience, hey, we're big enough for you now. We're here. You can trust us, and to grow their audience and their hopefully consumer base much wider. So I think, yeah, fewer time is spent on TV, which would explain on cable TV, right? Which would explain that decline. More touch points means you've got to divide it up more, and we've just got to follow where we're going. And I don't think that's shiny new objects necessarily. I think some of them are. I think some of them, though, you know, like online video is one of the top, right? That's been around for ages now. Like, we should figure it out and how to be successful on that. And luckily, like, I think a lot of us have, but it's just a more diverse portfolio of where you want to show up and how, to me, at least.
Yeah. What do you think, Rachel?
I think, Tessa, you come to this discussion with a lot of really interesting insight from the, you know, in-depth work that you do with your clients. I think what you've said there about diversifying your portfolio of, you know, sort of channels and mediums as a brand is really interesting. Also, your views there on the convergence of, measurement, attribution, and outcomes is really interesting, because I think this story and this conversation, which, you know, we've sort of been having on and off as we, you know, tap into the figures that are telling us what's happening in the TV world. We've been having this conversation on and off for, you know, at least 12 months, I'd say. So as that situation keeps moving, I think we're seeing another inflection point here, where what we're going to be talking about, you know, over the coming sort of 12 to 24 months is not, are brands spending in TV or not? It's going to be much more nuanced than that. It's going to be, so if they are spending in TV, exactly what mediums and what platforms are they spending on TV within? Exactly what types of budget are they doing? Exactly what, you know, KPIs and outcomes are they looking to achieve with their TV advertising? And I think all of that is in flux, right? And you've just described, Tessa, how, brands traditionally thought about TV advertising, and therefore why even those younger companies that you mentioned still have that ambition to get this budget into a TV realm to go, look, you know, we're a real brand. We're a serious contender and competitor. We're now on TV advertising. Everyone needs to pay attention to us. But I think the way that consumers pay attention to all forms of advertising, TV included, is changing so dramatically that this picture is going to look really different in another 12 to 20, 24 months' time. And what we're seeing is that journey. So, you know, because I know, you know, even we had a networking drinks thing last night in London, just pre-to Mexico, which was great. You know, got lots of people in the industry down to a famous Irish pub in Soho called the Toucan, nearly got it shut down again, which is what we're specialists in.
Making me jealous, come on.
Well, I hasten to add, not through bad behaviour, just through, you know, too many people on the street. But anyway, and if you'd been here, Tessa, it would have been delightful to see you there. But anyway, we'll try and replicate it when we're in Singapore in a couple of weeks' time. But I digress. We were chatting. I was chatting with a couple of people there about retail media and this constant debate about where the budgets for retail media are coming from within brands. Are they fresh budgets? Are they shopper marketing budgets? Obviously, it depends on the brand and where they would typically spend. But there's a lot of debate about it coming from what was TV budgets, you know, brands actually saying, no, we're not going to spend that money in a TV environment anymore. We're going to shift it somewhere else altogether. And so I think you're going to continue to see that happen as brands navigate their way around this increased complexity across the advertising and marketing industry in general, but also within these mediums. And TV is an example of one that is just shifting so much and quite quickly that it must be difficult for some brands to get to grips with where their money is best spent at the moment. And maybe that's reflected, Tessa, in some of the conversations you have with brands. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And it always comes back to KPIs, right? Like, what are you setting out to achieve? I think something that I am quite happy with, and I don't think this is like contentious, but I think it can be scary, is that I also think when we focus more on attention, right, we're shifting away from KPIs that can be achieved through a budget. And what I mean by that is, like, if you have a media budget, whether you spend it on TV or online video, etc., then you always have an aim from media companies, right? That, okay, you're going to get this many eyeballs, this many clicks. That's how you can change it for performance. I think in some part, in some campaigns, shifting to add to those metrics of what are people doing after this and what are they walking away from? So whether it's a focus on brand recall or brand sentiment or on literal conversion, that's driving a lot of these conversations to focus not just on getting the eyeballs, but on putting out work that people want to see. I mean, one of the things I noticed on that chart, right, was like digital out of home, cinema, and I think like point of sale ads are amongst the top when it comes to getting attention. Now, again, if you're someone like me that has innovation in their title, that might be at first glance a little scary, right? Does that mean, you know, social ads, video ads, all these things people don't like? But I was thinking about it, and I actually think it's intriguing because when you think about it, when people are in those settings, and you said it, Rachel, I think, when we're talking about the second story, when you see a nice out of home, you stop, right? You're like, wow, I'm so lucky that I get to see this. Isn't it interesting? But guaranteed, you see at least tens of out of home every day that don't even make it into your brain because they're not captivating. When you're at the cinema, right, you already have to be quiet because the lights have dimmed, you know, they play that whole thing about turning off your phone and not talking to people. I think you're in the mindset to consume something that's interesting. Same thing for digital out of home. When you're at the bus shelter or if you're in a taxi or something and you're seeing something interesting, right? That's going to pull you in. Point of sale is one of the most fascinating places because that's where, you know, when I learned that like even how people package things, right? Where if there's eyes on the boxes, where are they looking? What level are they on? Are they right by the cash register? What are they next to? How can we make this pop beyond just, it's not random cardboard, right? It's made with a reason. But I say that because those three mediums are where brands are trying and achieving being interesting. And that's what we tell our clients, right? You have to be, and I don't want to mix that up. Interesting is not the same as entertaining. So it doesn't mean, to me at least, that like every brand needs to go out and do something crazy or like only work with influencers in this way, etc. Interesting can be serious. Interesting can be eye-catching. Interesting can be entertaining. It can be audio-based. But if you're making interesting things, then people will consume what you're doing, regardless of where it's popping up. If you're not making interesting things, which I think is sadly some of the case with some of the other touch points that I'm really passionate about, of course you're going to get the scroll through or the lack of attention, etc. And that's what we talk to a lot of our clients about is it can't be just about what message you want to tell. It has to be about what kind like customers are going through that you can relate to in a unique, differentiated way. And I think that is strategic, but it's also the ability to be super creative, right? Not just with where you show up, but being very mindful of how you show up in each of those spaces. I think that was a really long-winded answer to your question, but that's something that, other than false advertising, that I'm very passionate about.
Well, but that makes sense, especially, you know, if you do a lot of work with innovation in your job title, you do a lot of work in a gaming and online environment, right? Exactly as you just, you know, you just alluded to. You want to start seeing really quality, creative advertising experiences in those environments, because that's what's going to work. That's what's going to capture people. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because the article referenced, you know, what, you know, the top three mediums that captures consumers' attention, and then the top three mediums that they try to ignore. And there's online mobile game ads at the top.
I know.
Which, you know, that must have been one of the ones that made you go, oh, God. But, you know, it could be so much better is the point. It's not, this is a terrible environment for advertising. It's that it could be so much better. And time again, when you're seeing surveys of consumers in those environments, I'd say that mobile gamers or gamers in general are probably really harsh and judgmental about advertising in that environment, which is a good thing, because hopefully that's going to drive better quality advertising and engagement in that environment, because the whole point is advertisers are getting it wrong, you know, they're in potentially a myriad of ways, but, you know, quite likely along the lines that you've just suggested, they're thinking too much about the message they're trying to put out and not enough about the ways that they could be creative in interacting with consumers in that environment. So yeah. And I suppose getting back to the wider point of the article, you know, are brands and marketers thinking about where they shift their budget and questioning TV because it's no longer the shiny new object? It also gets back to, I think you mentioned this earlier on too, Tessa, it also gets back to where the audiences are. And we can see from the previous, you know, from the earlier conversation about YouTube, you know, consumers are moving all over the show, right? And, you know, YouTube user volume numbers are sort of contracting for some age demographics and massively expanding for others. And then you look at what's happening on those other platforms, it's moving, it's a really fast moving picture. And I think that's going to influence the way agencies advise their clients to navigate around TV, right?
Totally, it's got to.
Yeah, and it's, you know, TV is something that we're talking about a lot here in the office this year. Future of TV is one of our pillars for Industry Review 2024, so we're doing a lot around it at the moment. And one of the main questions that we're hitting upon is, what really is TV? And I think we've touched on that, Tessa, with you, the fragmentation.
Exactly,
the air quotes of what is television. So we'll be investigating more. But yeah, thank you very much for your input on those stories. I'm fascinated by your job title, Tessa, as head of innovation.
So am I. I mean, it changes every day, right? Where it's focused. That's fun.
It's one of those job titles where people could give you anything, right? This is innovation. We'll give it to Tessa.
To enable curiosity. Come on.
Yeah.
So how's everything going for you at TBWA? What are you working on? And you mentioned your passions before. What are you enjoying at the moment in the industry?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I mean, getting through COVID, right, has been a journey. Yeah. And then to come out of that and go into what seems to be a recession, it could be challenging, right? But all things considered, I think across APAC, we're doing really well. I mean, a lot of things excite me. I think we just completed a white paper with TikTok across the region that kind of blew my mind. I mean, TikTok is probably my favorite platform as a consumer right now. To be on, like, the average person spends 55 minutes a day on it. I definitely spend like 45. And the other interesting stat to come out of that was, like, across APAC at least, over 60% of TikTok's audience is over 25. So that myth of, you know, being just young, dance-focused, music-focused thing is proven false. I love focusing on that because there's so many different perspectives. And I think that's one of the joys of marketing, right? We're hired for our experience and hopefully our curiosity and creativity that you've got to keep learning. And I love that learning and then sharing that knowledge is part of my job. I think we're lucky to work with like a lot of really interesting clients across the region, whether it's Nissan or McDonald's or Weechi or the like. And there's always fascinating stuff that, of course, when it's in the works, we can't talk about, but it's coming through. But I think my favorite thing about this job right now is, you know, I spent 7 years, the last 7 years before moving to Singapore in New York. And I love New York, though I'm a Canadian. I'm told my accent has been lost a little bit by my family. They're dismayed. But being in New York is amazing, right? Like the culture is so fast paced. You feel like all of these like amazing things are happening around you. But I purposefully wanted to come to Asia because when you look at the data, you see that's where all the early adoption of innovation is, whether it's live commerce or gaming or even like blockchain technology or all these different things, right? That's happening here. And yet we don't always see enough brand movement when it comes to APAC. And I feel like we're too often lured into, you know, the US or even though you guys are based there, of course, Europe and everywhere has great things. But our focus here is we have the consumer action. How can we translate that into brands taking action to really capitalize upon these millions of people across very diverse markets that are ready and already doing it, whereas sometimes in other markets that can be a bit stunty. So that's probably my favorite thing of my job. I mean, every day is a little bit different, right? Everyone kind of belays like advertising so fast paced, and it is. But I think the best thing is, as I said, like you get to learn every day. And that's why I love a good debate. But I think having like really finite opinions on things in this day and age is kind of bizarre, unless it's like, you know, obviously like deep rooted moral things like X is bad or this is good. But like shiny new objects or what we're going to do about this award or this thing, to me, it's kind of a thing that should be of the past, I guess.
Tessa, what do you think the barrier? I mean, that was a really interesting rundown of sort of, you know, innovation and early adoption and consumer behavior in APAC. What do you think the barrier is then for brands in APAC not moving as fast as consumers are? Because you're right, we watch Asia with such fascination from other corners of the globe. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, ExchangeWire is so active in APAC, because it's just such a fascinating marketplace. So yeah, what do you think the barrier is there for brands?
Yeah, and I think, look, brands are getting more comfortable at jumping on it. I think the biggest barrier is de-risking it. Because there, let's be real, it's not that it's risky, it's that it hasn't been proven out as much as other mediums, right? So like oftentimes, and this might sound a little depressing from an innovation person, but I feel like a lot of my time can be spent on the math of it all as well. Like if you do X and there's X many people here and you achieve this amount of conversion, then that will equate to this, to show that it's not a shiny object. Like the opportunity is there and you stand the chance of achieving more of whatever your KPI is often if you take that jump. But I think sometimes when we as an industry talk about these areas of innovation, we do it in a very alienating way, right? Because like it's very easy to come in and be like, I'm going to use all this tech jargon and all these stats and all these things because I want everyone to think that I'm really smart and we're on the cusp of the future. And sure, I get it. But when you're talking to businesses and you're trying to convince them to do something that they haven't done before, and you know, their revenue relies on the success of that, their promotion relies on that, sometimes their job, that's a lot of responsibility that you can't ask someone to take that jump because we have just a really interesting creative idea. If it's new, it's our responsibility, I think, to de-risk it. And that has to come down to data. And that's like our way in to making sure that we can showcase how it makes sense and how to do it in a phased approach versus just a few random what-offs like that are going to be much more risky and aren't going to be able to stand up to achieve the results that you're after at on a business or brand level.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, it was fascinating. Thanks so much, Tessa. That is all we have time for on the Mad Tech podcast today. But thank you so much for your time and joining us. That was a really great discussion. Thanks, Tessa.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you both. And John, even though you didn't talk much, I appreciate it, the joke you got in. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That's my one thing ticked off for the week. Thank you, Tessa. Rachel, thank you very much as always. Cheers for joining.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech podcast. We will see you again next week. Thank you.